Well, one of the problems that we've encountered in the work that we did was in first trying to define what we really meant by a software reliability problem in itself. And the first problem, of course, was to try and define what we meant by software faults. And in this, we ran into a lot of problems, but basic to it all, we came to the conclusion that a software fault could be defined as any failure that was introduced into the software, either accidentally or through some other mechanism. In other words, as the software itself was generated, faults could be introduced into it, and these faults would then be the cause for a failure. When we try to draw the analogy between software and hardware, we would look at hardware and say, well, you don't purposely design a fault into hardware, but after a certain amount of wear, the hardware then begins to fail, and so then we define that as a hardware reliability. For software, we finally decided that the best approach was when a fault occurs in software and is discovered, that then is a fault which can be attributed to the software, and from that we tried to draw the analogy, as was described in the paper, to software reliability.
Well, Marty, I think one thing that you're alluding to here is how does one recognize that a failure has occurred? I made a comment during my pitch that this can be either in terms of results, or it can be in terms of a system crash or degradation to some point where either throughput is unacceptable or you are no longer meeting the real-time constraints in some other fashion. John's comment is well taken, that this is a hard thing to separate out. There's obviously no wear out with software. So the analogy is perhaps a warped one where you go back and say, even though they were there, they were in fact undiscovered. Really, it's the same thing if you look at what is the effect on your overall system.
I think we would have to agree that when we talk about a fault, in the end result, it does not matter whether that fault crept in because of a misinterpretation of specifications. For example, I asked someone to write a program to solve for the roots of a quadratic equation. He did, but he didn't think to take into account the fact that they might be imaginary roots. Then when I tested it, suddenly the program failed. Well, this is an error just as surely as if he had started with the correct algorithm and miscoded a do loop. It's an error just as surely as if he had written down the correct code and for some reason it was wrongly key punched on a card, and the error was not a syntactical one that the compiler could catch, but was one that, you know, propagated through the code and so on. I think we have to say that if it interrupts operation, and in the operational sense, an error is an error is an error. However, I think it's very relevant for us to study types of errors and types of faults if we want to try and write code that has a smaller error content. Because then, if we have some idea of the types of bugs, some people have called this etymology, study of computer bugs, then at least we can look toward techniques for reducing these. Now, I would like to turn to another question, and that is the effect of large-scale integration on computer reliability. As we all know, the reliability of computer hardware has in some ways been predicted as vastly increasing due to integrated circuits and integrated circuit technology. I would like to see someone comment on whether they feel integrated circuits have already improved computer hardware reliability. And as we go to larger and larger scale integration, whether it will continue to improve. I read recently that Texas Instruments has come out with a single integrated circuit chip for $20 in large quantities, which does all the functions of a desktop calculator. This is quite large-scale integration. One chip, a whole desktop calculator. Would someone like to comment on that?
At present, there are, of course, there's a very little actual hard data on the reliability of LSI in a computer. You can get reliability data on LSI, tested LSI, but again, there's much missing between that and what it means for the computer. Most computer manufacturers, at least those who address themselves to military and space applications, use so-called transfer model method, in which papers have been published by people from Autonetics and Hughes and various journals. It seems to be reasonably well adapted to the transfer, however, here used in a different way, of reliability techniques from integrated circuit level to the medium scale and large scale integration level. As Marty has pointed out, the predictions that you arrive when you use that model is a large, very significant increase in reliability of the chips, or of the functions which are in the chips. That means that one of the poles that had been holding up the tent, namely semiconductor reliability, has suddenly kind of disappeared into the ground, but we are still looking at quite a few other poles of the tent, like memory and memory logic, which in memory logic for some reason cannot be very readily LSI'd. Memory logic turns out to be one of the remaining tent poles. Power supply and power distribution and cabling undoubtedly is another one of the tent poles that we're looking at now. I/O devices, again. So there are indications that the advent of LSI has indeed greatly reduced the failure probability due to semiconductors as such. It does not probably make quite that much difference to the computer structure as a whole.
The advent of LSI, I think, means that you can afford to do more circuit analysis on the circuit, more detailed work. Let's not forget that you can have a logic circuit fail and fail not continually without a part being out of spec or anything being wrong. I've forgotten exactly what they call these things, but essentially all you need to do is have a feedback loop such that a flip-flop gets flipped when it shouldn't have been. And it's an internal timing problem. When logic is designed gate by gate, these creep into the circuits. And I think when you have a real large LSI arrangement, you can afford to do more timing analysis and more thorough design so that these problems will not be there.
Another question from the floor. On determination of computer programs versus randomness of data, can one group of data cause software programs to yield nebulous or even erroneous or misleading results, whereas a similar group of data may yield meaningful or correct results? You're implying the same program with one set of data that yields meaningless results, another set of data that yields correct results?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll turn to that. Well, I think it's clear that one can and must define his test as a function of the input data. I've heard people conjecture that even if you're to try and solve or try and test for a polynomial solving program where each of the coefficients can vary between minus 10 and plus 10, this requires a huge number of tests because of all the various combinations. Clearly, you could test your program for a subset of all the combinations, it could work very nicely. Then suddenly some particular combination, the program blows up and doesn't work. I think that the numbers zero and the numbers minus are typical areas in which this happens. I recently heard somebody telling war stories. This is what somebody calls stories about particular bugs that occur in computer programs. He calls them war stories. And the war story he was telling me was a rather large piece of software had to be initialized at the beginning to say how many processes it was supporting. It was a multiprocessing piece of software. And of course, generally it supported 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, some numbers like this. During one stage of the development testing, someone decided they wanted to turn off this portion of the operating system algorithm. And they decided the easiest way was rather than to try and cut it out of the program, you know, that's awful, they would just put in zero processes and that would turn it off. They put in zero processes, the program crashed because the designer had never anticipated anybody would ever have zero processes there. And this is a common thing. The number zero is an awful thing sometimes for computer logic.
I'd like to make a comment on that, too. I think the answer to your question is dependent upon what kinds of error recovery mechanisms may be in your code. If you've written something, for example, and have taken advantage of reasonableness checks throughout the code, say at task level, I think you can very easily, by varying input data, exceed the thresholds on these reasonableness checks and deliberately induce a crash. It's a function of design, and have you done anything like that, or are you using handshake bits or something else to handle your error recovery? Overload would be another consideration. I don't want to touch on the military systems for obvious reasons, but if your program were designed to, say, process so many reservations, perhaps, on an airline, if you overloaded it, you've got to tell the program what to do with that. Do we ignore it? Do we queue it? You know, what do we do? So I think the answer to your question is pretty dependent on some of the boundary conditions of the design of the code.
Let's take up a rather large question. There are lots of techniques for improving computer hardware reliability. High reliability parts, parity bit checking, majority voting, multiprocessing, redundant computers. NASA, in their manned space flight center, has 5 parallel 360 Model 75 computers. And apparently, there was quite a bit of comment as to whether they really needed so many. People commented, well, 2, 3 perhaps, but why 5? On a recent mission, 4 of them were down, and the single one was operating. I had someone muse, wondering whose job it was to make sure that they inserted enough bugs to prove that 4 went down. But basically the question is, what about all these different techniques? Which are better? Do they complement one another? Are they used at different levels? Can someone comment on that?
I want to comment on a small part of the question, and in part, this is... I guess I'm sniping at Steve a little bit. But I question if, you know, in a computer system or a computing system, particularly a real-time system, if there is really such a thing as redundancy. And the approach that I'm taking to this, I'm looking at the system cost of a crash, even given that there is some standby unit that's not hooked up in series with a process that can be put in. And I wonder here if the system cost is not such as to make the value of the reliability, kind of going back to what my friend on the right here had to say, meaningless. So I guess I'm answering a question with a question, Marty.
Uh, I think the redundancy is always based on a simplex system. I agree with you that if you need this type of thing, you might not want to consider it as redundancy as such. It's simply redundancy over the simplex system. With respect to the overall question, I can give some opinions, certainly not ones that I could offer a great deal of proof on, but first of all, I think that hardware techniques, now again, this is for checking, not for operational programs or anything, are far more desirable than software techniques if they could accomplish that the functions that one requires, and also they are checkable themselves. We greatly underestimated the problems with software maintenance programs. We thought this was going to be a rather small task. Many of the systems, it turned out to be hundreds of thousands of words of code for maintenance programs. It's true on the ESS system, it's true on a Polaris system. With respect to massive redundancy versus selective redundancy, there's two considerations. One is cost, and the other is reliability. Obviously, there's a cost problem here, and I don't care how cheap components are getting, it's still going to cost you more to have 300% redundancy than 20% redundancy. So there is a cost problem. The other question is the reliability of additional hardware. It's not necessarily the case that redundancy enhances reliability. In many cases, it could be the antithesis of reliability, in that it increases the complexity of the system. This is particularly true of a quadded system. Tryon investigated this in depth. So selective redundancy seems to have a cost and reliability advantage if one could achieve it. Now, that's not clear that you can. That, I think, gets to the gist of the question, which are the best techniques? Well, for the most part, I don't think there are any best techniques as they stand presently. They're very architecture-dependent, though, on the system. One problem that we face in this area continually is that the designers are not necessarily conscious of the reliability requirements and don't attack their design with this in mind. Consequently, the diagnostician then gets it, and he has to try to fudge some checks on this or just resort to massive redundancy. You don't necessarily have to do this if you take this into consideration during your design phase. For example, a single error detecting and correcting code is fine if my failures in memory are going to be single failures. But if my drivers are driving multiple bits so that I will, yes, detect the one that occurred in that particular word, but X number of other words in my memory also have a failure now induced in them and I know nothing about it, well, then a single error detecting and correcting code is useless. Some advantages that we have found is that overlapping checks become extremely effective, something similar to multiple residues for residue codes, where now you have the checkers checking one another plus overlapping the data. This seems to be very attractive at various levels. Some of the techniques are extremely simple. Design a current summing device to test the output of decoders and did a cost evaluation of this using TI components, single components, no massive purchase or anything. It costs $5.60, and I can tell you any time an address decoder for a memory goes down. So these techniques are applicable only to certain types of decoders. So then again, it's very architecture dependent, and these things should be considered all at once, way back at the beginning, and this is an extremely difficult task to get the designer to work in conjunction with the diagnostician. In actuality, they should probably be the same individual.
I believe all answers that you have tried to elicit here have pointed out that there ain't no answer. And we are here partly, at this symposium partly to talk about the problems, but it might also be incumbent upon us to do something about them. And the one problem that I believe that we might address ourselves to in the terms of doing something about it is to say we need more failure information about computers, because you cannot solve computer failures in the absolute or in the most general term. It's a downside better and more cost effective to say we are addressing memory failures and perhaps one particular type of memory failure, rather than to say we are addressing computer failures. And some national information exchange for where do computer failures occur by structure and how do they manifest themselves might be very useful. I'd be glad to hear from members of the audience how they feel about organizing something like that.
Of course, several attempts, Ryerson, Hughes Aircraft, several attempts have been made to do this in various areas of reliability over the years, and it's always been apparent that communication between the people giving the information was so bad that the data that you got out of such collaborative efforts were pretty puny. It hardly paid for itself in many cases. We've just gone through a complete detailed analysis of roughly 32 billion part hours of IC failure rate data. And this is for NASA contract. And many interesting things came out of it. Among other things was that most of the data is garbled between burn-in data, early failure data, and long-time data. And there's just so many different types of failures involved with no clear definition either of the type of failure or the stresses that went into the causing that failure to occur, that it's very difficult to come up with conclusions from the raw data or from the summarized data from the field that have much validity. However, some very interesting things come out, and I think this question of when do you know that you have a thorough test, and I think there are two things that you can do on any system and keep testing until two things happen. One is that your failure rate gets down to where you feel it's a reasonable failure rate for the complexity of the system and the number of potential failure items involved, and the other is to keep testing until you get the failure mode distribution constant for time stress. The point here is that no particular failure mode can continue to occur at a higher than a normal rate unless that represents a device which is overloaded or it's a misdesign or it's a real bad part in the system. And when the failure mode distribution becomes constant with time stress, this says you're down on the tail of the burn-in distributions and you're getting close to the point where now you have the inherent bottom of the bathtub characteristic essentially. And all you have to worry about then is such things as wear out. And this is true. The question came up on microcircuits. Are they really going to be more reliable? And yes, I think the evidence is that they will be more reliable. The new extra large scale or the LC microcircuits, I think, are very promising. But they do have additional problems. There is wear out of these devices, especially in the hybrid units where you have very fine leads, which can vibrate with high frequencies applied and fatigue the wire, so you get a fatigue phenomena that is not normally exhibited in semiconductors. And if you're using these devices in any high radiation area, you get what amounts to a wear out of the semiconductor characteristics. And so that you do have the whole bathtub problem facing you. Is the system burned in? What is the inherent failure rate at the bottom of the bathtub, and have you achieved it with your system with the changes you've just put in and the new parts you've just put in? And are you subject now, after all this testing, to having worn out some of the things and fatigued the bonds, fatigued the wires, and so on? There is, of course, the Ferrata data, which has a lot of information, and most of which you can't use, and there's the RACIT data, RACIAT, that the Air Force has collected, which is contaminated by a lot of these things I've mentioned. And there are other sources of data, but as I say, in any one case, you're almost going to have to use your own information in order to tell whether you thoroughly screened your device or not.
Frank Applegate, Honeywell. I'd like to comment in several ways on this general idea of data. Years ago, we had quite a push in the reliability field to generate more and more general data that other people could use in their reliability work. This proved helpful in some cases. In other cases, it proved to be a disaster. And my general opinion on this, I might sum up by answering Dr. Evans' editorial. And if there's one thing worse than a statistician or a mathematician performing mathematical gymnastics is to give him non-relevant numbers that he can exercise. But to be more specific, the real problem with providing data is really this one of applicability. Every computer manufacturer puts out computers of rather totally different design concepts and approaches. His computers fail due to both hardware and software for rather specific reasons. In fact, there's quite a school of reliability people that preach there is no such thing as random failures, they're all deterministic. Well, whether that is so or not, I think it is relevant that most of the failures we see are in fact deterministic, and we will correct them when we get enough evidence to show us where they are. But to take data of this nature and apply it to computer technology in general, I think is very bad, probably far worse than to generalize on part application, because even a simple thing like a resistor, purchased under certain criteria, applied under other criteria, and used in different environments, all have different failure rates. And if we can't generalize in that case, we certainly can't generalize in the more difficult case of computer data. I think that I could speak for most manufacturers that whereas they do have data, they are very reluctant to provide this data openly because of the ifs, ands, whys, and wherefores associated with that data, would be very happy to discuss their data with a, let's say, a specific need in mind by someone that had need for it and was using it applicable to their own equipment. But I certainly would have no use to pick up IBM data as applicable to our products, and the only information I would get from it is how good or how bad they were. But it would be virtually useless to me in terms of improving our own products, and I think that's what reliability is all about in the first place.
Well, I would like to comment. First of all, I disagree that part failure data has been useless. I notice that in our session, there was a paper by Dr. Jerwitz of Saab, who went through a before-the-fact reliability analysis using part failure rates, predicted a 700-hour mean time between failure for a spaceborne computer and an aircraft computer. After the computer was built, he ran through tests. The test turned out, once the data was analyzed, to predict a mean time between failure of about 750 hours. To me, this is excellent agreement between a prediction technique and between actual tests on the actual system. I think that without having this tool to try and predict from his initial design what the computer would do, the design would have been based on hunches and hearsay and guesses. And if I were a manager, I wouldn't want to place millions of dollars in somebody's hands to build me something based on hunches and hearsay and guesswork. I would want some calculations. Admittedly, these calculations are often inaccurate. There are problems with it. But I think at this stage, in the 1970s, we see many more successes with reliability prediction than we see failures. There are still failures, but I think there are more successes. And I would think the same applies to reliability data for computers, too. The environment is different. Now no longer do we talk about the temperature of a resistor, or perhaps the vibration level on a gyroscope. Now perhaps we talk about the load in terms of users, or perhaps the data transfer rate between core memory and disks, or core memory and drums. Perhaps these are the factors in the environment that we must take into account. Obviously, they're much different than what we would do previously, but they're still there. I think the concept of environmental conditions, the concept of a defined goal is still there, so I disagree. I think I would like to just pose at the close of our panel session two more questions that I think should be briefly discussed to round out some of the ideas that we've mulled over. We've talked about trying to identify problems in software and hardware failure. We've talked about techniques to try and predict them and so on. Let's talk a little bit about techniques for designing and for improving computers, techniques for designing and improving computer programs. And we've discussed a little bit of this in terms of redundancy with respect to computer hardware. Now, with respect to computer software, there have been two techniques that people have come forth with. One is the technique of structured programming that Professor Dijkstra in Holland and Harlan Mills of IBM in Virginia have published extensively on. And this technique involves, instead of building up your software from the bottom up, integrating modules into processes, processes into a system finally, putting it all together, and only really having a working system at the last step, once you integrate all your processes together, they suggest you start from the top down. You build a control program first with a small number, perhaps 50 instructions, lots of sub-programs, lots of begin-end blocks to segregate the code. Transfer of control is to only go to the instruction at the beginning of the code and to only leave from the instruction at the end of the code. Absolutely taboo are go-to instructions that transfer control from the middle of one block to the other. People have begun to study this technique. Some people claim that it has large advantages and they've started to use it. I wonder whether someone would like to comment on their possibly experiences or their thoughts on whether they think this technique will bear value in the future as essentially a design technique for software.
First, add one other name to it, Butler Lampson. I believe he's with Xerox now. He was with Berkeley Computer. And he's in Palo Alto now, I believe. He's also talked on the same subject. Unfortunately, Butler Lampson was president of a computer company that went broke. And I don't know how we can tie this in with the ideas. But I've got a hunch that if you do write a structured program the way Dijkstra or Lampson or one of these others would like to have you do, the amount of overhead, in other words, non-working instructions in the program, instructions that just keep the computer running, the amount of overhead is intolerable. Another example of this, it's perfectly possible to design software so deadlocks can be prevented. But as far as I know, no computer manufacturer has put this into his software because it's just too damn expensive. Effectively, what you have to do is test every situation before you do anything. In other words, you got to drive down the street to see if it's safe to drive down the street. And that's just too expensive. So there will always be problems remaining that are just uneconomical to solve.
I might comment on my own question. That I've spoken recently with some people at Bell Laboratories who have begun to try out the technique of structured programming, and although they haven't set up any controlled experiment, which would be nice, whereby you would code one program without using the technique, using conventional techniques, another one using it, and try and compare such things as program size, as you suggested, speed of operation, and most importantly, number of bugs in the program, and so on. They have said that their initial tests have a much greater probability of success. In other words, the first time they take and integrate the program together on the computer, the most general experience is that it never works. And since they started writing some structured code, they're getting a reasonable percentage of programs that initially work. So although it's not a scientific measure, they have a pretty good feeling that it seems to have borne some advantages.
Could that not be the result of just paying more attention to the coding because it is structured? This seems to be the case with many beginning programmers. They do much better when they're starting because they pay attention to what they're doing, and as they get more experience, they'll take risks.
I think what you're referring to is some people refer to as the Hawthorne effect, because at the Hawthorne installation in the Bell system, some very famous psychologists ran some experiments, and what they did was they changed the colors of the walls and told everybody it would be easier on their eyes, and production went up. They changed the increased the lighting, production went up. They changed this, production went up. And finally, they became suspicious. And then they reduced the lighting level and said, we studied it and it's too bright now. They reduced the lighting level to what it previously was, and production again went up. And they painted the walls the previous color because they said, now we've decided this one is better, and production still went up. So the motivational psychologist concluded that the main effect here was the fact that these production line workers, which had been previously ignored, suddenly got a tremendous amount of attention, and everybody was explaining to them why they were going to help them out and why their production was going to increase, and sure enough, their production did increase. I would like to just ask to comment on one concluding question. We have some time limitations on the use of the room. People have talked about something called program validation, or proving programs correct, where they have proposed mathematical proofs for the programs. I have a feeling that there's a limited amount that one can do with this. I wonder whether someone else would like to comment on that.
I think probably that is restricted, even in small cases, to deterministic programming. It certainly would seem like it would not be very likely in heuristic programming, which most of our more complex problems of the present and more so of the future will be. I'm not sure how you would prove a heuristic mathematically correct, because then I doubt that it would be a heuristic any further.
We've made a little study on this, and all the techniques that are available today are more than linear in complexity. In other words, if the program has 100 lines, it might take 500 lines to prove it. However, if it has 1,000 lines, it will take many, many more than 5,000 lines to prove it. The function is exponential, it is not linear. So the larger the program, the greater the increase in the amount of effort it takes to prove it correct. And that's true for all the techniques that are in use today. And the authority on this is McCarthy's Artificial Intelligence Lab at Stanford. So it's not very hopeful at the present time.
I think that concludes our time. If there are any further questions, the panel members will be up here and the audience can approach them individually. Thank you. Thank you.